Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got a couple of segments up tonight, or today, rather. First, we'll be speaking in a few minutes with Stephen Mim, a historian who is a co-author, along with Nouriel Roubini of Crisis Economics, a crash course in the future of finance, just out from Penguin. And then at the bottom of the hour, we will be taking a look at Cuban economic reform. There was certainly a big splash headline around the world when Fidel Castro told a pair of visiting journalists, the Cuban model doesn't work for us anymore. And shortly after that quote made its way around the world, the Cuban authorities announced that they were about to lay off 500,000 people from state enterprises. What is going on with the Cuban economy? Is the about the last bastion of old-style socialism falling prey to the capitalist tsunami? And we will get a point of view of a brief comments from Julia Zweig, the consul in foreign relations, who is one of the people who met Fidel. And then an interview recorded with Kirby Jones, who is a consultant who talks to U.S. companies who would like to do business in Cuba. And there are some of those, believe it or not. But first, some words on the news. Thursday morning brought the release of the Census Bureau's annual income, poverty, and health insurance numbers. These are drawn from a special edition of the Bureau's monthly current population survey. The regular survey, which covers about 60,000 households, is what the monthly unemployment figures, among other things, are based on. This special survey, done every March, covers 100,000 households. It's a very large sample, although it's far from perfect, as I'll elucidate in a bit. The headline findings are that incomes were down, poverty was up, and millions lost their health insurance last year. This is just what you'd expect in a recession, of course. A few words about each. First, income. The median income of all households, median income is that income at the middle of the distribution, meaning half the people are richer than the median and half poorer, it fell by almost 1% last year, but the move was deemed not large enough to be statistically significant. That is, the likely error in the estimate is larger than the change itself. But the overall number was helped considerably by a near 6% rise in incomes for households headed by someone 65 or over. The concept of a head of household, usually the person's name on a deed or lease, is problematic, but it's not my terminology. Under 65 households saw their income fall by 1.3%, and this did pass the test of statistical significance. Especially hard hit were the young, foreign-born non-citizens, and blacks. So-called Hispanics held their own. Curiously, residents of central cities did a lot better than suburbanites or country dwellers. Taking a longer-term look, median household income in 2009 was just 2% above where it was in 1989, even though real GDP was up 63% over the same period. Of course, population is up over the period, and not all of GDP takes the form of personal income. Some of it goes to corporations, some to governments. But real disposable personal income per capita, that is, the total of income after taxes throughout the entire economy divided by the population, is up 40% over the last 20 years. So on paper, or at least the Silicon equivalent, were things being distributed equally, the average household would have gained about 20 times more income than it has in reality. The reason for this disparity is, of course, that the rich have gotten most of the benefits of economic growth over the last few decades. The top 5% of the population, according to the census numbers, which badly understate things for technical reasons I'll go into a moment, has gotten 25% of the growth in income over the last 20 years. The top 20% altogether has gotten just over half of all income growth, 54%. There are several reasons why the census numbers understate incomes at the top. One is that the very rich can't be bothered answering questionnaires from pesky civil servants. Another is that the Census Bureau treats all incomes over a certain amount, it rises every year, but it's now about $1 million, as if they were that amount. That is, if you have made $100 million, the Census Bureau would still think of that as $1 million. The stated reason for this is to protect confidentiality, since the records are available for public use. Maybe. But the effect is to seriously understate how well the very rich have done. For example, the census shows the top 5% gaining 28% from 1989 to 2009. Work based on tax records done by the economists Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez show that to be roughly true for households of the 95th percentile, that is, those richer than 95% of the population. But by missing those above that level, the seriously rich, the census understates things by almost two-thirds. Piketty and Saez have the top 5% gaining almost 75% from 1989 to 2007. The reason for this difference is the action at the very high end. The top 1% saw income gains over 100%. The top 1/100th of 1%, that is the richest 12,000 or so households in this country, with incomes averaging $35 million a year, they were up 215% over that 20-year period. That's almost 30 times the increase of the bottom 90% of the population. In other words, an enormous portion of the gains of economic growth over the last couple of decades have gone to just a few thousand hyper-rich households. All that said, the census numbers are a good measure of broad economic trends, even if they miss life in the stratosphere. A few other notes on income. The average black household's income fell to just below 60% of the average white household's, down nearly 2 percentage points from the previous year, and extending a downtrend that began when the boom of the 1990s burst in the early 2000s. At its early 2000 peak, the average black household hit 65% of the white average. That's now 5 percentage points lower. The average Hispanic household's income was just below 70% of its white counterpart, down a couple of points from a few years ago, but basically the neighborhood it's been in for years. The average Asian household's income was 120% of the white average last year, also more or less where it's been for the last several years. Now, poverty. Before proceeding, it's important to say that the U.S. poverty line is an extremely stingy thing. It's based on research done in the 1950s that showed that the average household spent a third of its income on food. So the Johnson administration, eager for metrics in its war on poverty, decided that a poverty line would be 3 times a minimal food budget as computed by the Agriculture Department. Never mind that that minimal food budget was considered something of an emergency measure, not something to live on indefinitely. They needed something in a hurry and went with it. And they've just adjusted that line for inflation ever since, with no notice paid to rising incomes or the changing nature of household budgets, like rising medical inflation or the need for childcare. So conceptually, a poverty income today is exactly the same in real dollar terms as it was almost 50 years ago, even though average incomes have more than tripled over the five-decade period. A more honest poverty line would produce numbers probably twice what I'm about to quote officialdom as reporting. Yet despite that undemanding standard, 14% of Americans were officially poor in 2009, up from 13% the previous year. This is the highest level since the early 1990s. It's almost certainly up this year since it tracks the unemployment rate pretty closely. The rate among white households was just over 9%. For black and Hispanic households, over 25%, or nearly 3 times the white rate. It's almost that high for households of any race with children under 6. And the percentage of people without health insurance for the entire year, not just a spell, but the entire year, so these are actually lowball numbers, that rose more than a percentage point to almost 17%, or 51 million people. Since people over 65 are covered by Medicare, giving that age group nearly 100% medical care coverage, it's worth looking at the under 65 crowd. Almost 19% of them were without insurance for the whole year. That's nearly 1 in 5 without insurance for the entire year. That share rises to 30%, nearly 1 in 3 for young adults, those under 35. So a bad year for the mass of the American population, and it's likely that 2010 was equally bad or worse. And this news will be reported for a day or two and then forgotten as the TV returns to moaning about the sufferings of the rich who desperately need their tax breaks renewed. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about economic crisis.
I need money 'cause I've had none.
And that a bit of the first of three versions of I Fought the Law. We'll hear that's the most famous original version, although not the first, which is by the Bobby Fuller Four. We'll hear a couple more as the show goes on. And now we're joined by Stephen Mim, who is a history professor at the University of Georgia and co-author of Nouriel Roubini, of the book Crisis Economics, A Crash Course in the Future of Finance, just published by Penguin. Welcome to Stephen Mim.
Hi, good to be here.
So I'm guessing that your contribution to this book was the historical stuff more than the technical economic stuff, right?
That is correct. It's a book that's kind of evenly split between historical context and analysis of the crisis, and then, of course, policy prescriptions as well.
And since this is a country afflicted with a severe case of historical amnesia, let's bring you in to do a little therapeutic work. And I'm wondering if collaborating with Nouriel Roubini now gets you invited to lots of glamorous parties filled with models.
Nouriel is certainly well known for his very active social life and his glamorous his glamorous ways. I am still just a history professor, and so if I get tended to be invited to things, it's to fairly staid policy meetings and things like that. So no supermodels.
Anyway.
Yet.
yet. We could always dream, can't we? The crisis that we've been living through, which is certainly not over, but it seems like the most intense period is at least over for now. It's certainly not the first in American history, although people sometimes act as if it is. But how does this compare and contrast with the many crises of the 19th century, 1837, 57, 73? There were many of them. What are the similarities and differences?
Well, certainly the similarities are the intensity. In the 19th century in the United States, there were a number of devastating financial crises that literally threw vast numbers of people out of work on the street and shuttered banks and other financial firms. So in that way, it's very much in keeping with that. It's also very similar, too, in that many of those crises that we saw in the 19th century, and then, of course, into the 20th century with the Great Depression, were not confined to the United States. They were global crises. And this crisis certainly was and arguably continues to be a global crisis. So those are very important parallels, and they conform with your sort of classic model of how financial crises have worked and always worked. The differences are, in part, the speed with which this one went, in many ways, viral, and the way that it was able to topple firms that had thought a lot about crisis management in a way that 19th century firms had not. And in theory had taken steps to prevent putting themselves in a position where they would come up short in a crisis. For example, buying effectively insurance on certain kinds of securities in the form of, say, a credit default swap. Of course, we all know now that a lot of the machinery that was created in theory to eliminate the risk of crisis actually magnified the crisis. And that's an interesting point and a distinction, I think, that comes with this crisis compared to the earlier historical precedents.
You quote Martin Van Buren, who became president in 1837, just as that crisis was hitting, saying, two nations, the U.S. and Britain, the most commercial in the world, enjoying recently the highest degree of apparent prosperity, are suddenly plunged into embarrassment. I love that 19th century word, embarrassment.
Yes, embarrassment.
And distress.
We should bring it back.
In both countries, we have witnessed the same redundancy of paper money and other facilities of credit, the same spirit of speculation, the same partial successes, the same difficulties and reverses, and at length, nearly the same overwhelming catastrophe. Aside from the antiquity of the language, it could describe today's headlines. Do we learn nothing from history?
I sometimes fear that we do, and I think that's what's very interesting is that a lot of the ways that Wall Street in particular, but certainly the City of London, the financial sector there, and then elsewhere around the world, the period in time when they really began to quote-unquote innovate, which is to say begin to think that they could escape history, was in the 1970s and 1980s as the partners who had come of age in the Great Depression were retiring. And I think in many ways the one silver lining of this crisis is that many people now have lived through it, and there's a chance, and it's certainly not a guarantee, that we may at least learn from it for the next few decades, that there's at least a hope or a possibility for that, just as much as people learned in the wake of the 1930s.
So that lesson stuck, the lesson of the 1930s stuck for about, what, 30 or 40 years?
Yeah, which is pretty good, actually, when you think about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a lifetime necessarily, but it's darn close.
But then, you know, starting in the, I guess, late 70s, early 80s, people who still remembered that thing or actually just read enough history to act as if they'd remember it. There does seem to be a belief now that you have to live through something personally for it to have any effect on you.
Right.
The kids these days, you know. But they began to be dismissed as old fuddy-duddies who just didn't really understand the way the world works now and the beauty
right.
of the market. Does that kind of transition have any historical precedent, or is this something
yes,
new?
Yes, it does. It actually does. For example, in Britain, you saw fairly catastrophic economic catastrophe, a little redundant there, but in 1720. And then there was a pretty long period, relatively speaking, where people were really cowed or humbled by that experience. And I think it left people with a real aversion to risk. And I think, so there probably has been similar instances of that in the past, and certainly, as I've said, after the Great Depression. But you're right, there was literally a generational divide in many of these firms where the fuddy-duddies, the guys who said, no, you really need to have, you know, a certain amount of capital, were brushed aside or ultimately put out to pasture.
But also, you know, in the 50s and 60s, people made money on Wall Street, no question about it, but they didn't make it in such enormous quantities. They weren't really living in an economic universe of their own relative to the rest of the population, right?
That is correct. And I think that is something that is in many ways, it's not the untold story, but it's one that people haven't yet fully grasped, which is that the share of the economy of the financial sector grew by leaps and bounds. From the 1970s onward in ways that are staggering if you really begin to think about it. The statistics that have come out of sort of the compensation from, you know, before the crisis, even during and after the crisis, are staggering. And that compensation, and this is a point we make in the book, was not simply a question of amount, which is bad enough. It is also a system of how people were compensated. In other words, how it was structured. For example, the bonus system very much put a premium on taking the firm's money and betting it, oftentimes in incredibly high-risk enterprises, because you would get the returns if you won, and the firm would shoulder the losses if you lost. So that was another feature of the compensation structure that I think hasn't fully been understood. It's the sheer amount of it is enough, is staggering enough. But the way it was structured, too, is important.
Well, it seems once you reach a certain level in society, there are really no consequences for failure as well. As this morning, I was at a session at the Council on Foreign Relations, Economic Outlook. They do these periodically. And Jacob Frankel was one of the people holding forth. And I looked at his bio. And he was governor of the Bank of Israel, had been at the IMF. But he also did some time at Merrill Lynch and AIG. And these are two notorious disasters, and yet here he is holding forth as an expert on the world economy. It's like, and then of course, people in the audience were quoting Alan Greenspan as some sort of authority. Like, it's just there's something badly awry in almost the cultural wiring when it comes to listening to people who've been proven wrong.
Right, and that kind of goes back to your point about, you know, what are the prospects for us learning from this mistake? I think the one thing that has happened in the wake of the crisis is that, and this is something, again, that wasn't fully appreciated at the time, it could have truly spun out of control. And had it done precisely that, the scars would run so much deeper and the shock would have been much more profound. And that would have been terrible, don't get me wrong. But it would have also probably given ammunition for people to, say, do much more aggressive reforms of the financial sector. The fact that the Fed and the other central banks around the world were able to ultimately, through effectively putting banks on life support, stop the crisis from spiraling out of control, I think it has created this illusion and thus given credibility to some of these figures who, you know, they're very smart individuals in many cases, but they may not be the best people to listen to about how to go from here.
I know you write a lot about Hyman Minsky, the great economist,
right.
Financial economist and follower of Keynes, who, by the way, his son Alan is the program director at our sister station, KPFK in Los Angeles. He said many things, many quotable aphorisms, but one of them is that stability is destabilizing. In some sense that just, you know, even because the crisis didn't spin as far out of control as it could have, because it didn't really repeat the 1930s, there's almost this sense of, well, the Hell's Angel, Sonny Barger, got into a motorcycle accident, was in a coma, woke up, and the nurse said, "I hope you learned your lesson, Mr. Barger." And he said, "Yes, I did." And she said, "Well, what's that?" And he said, "I can do anything and survive."
Right.
There seems to be something of that.
Yes, absolutely. There's a serious problem with what economists like to call moral hazard at this point, that, you know, effectively with the Fed stepping in and propping up everything, I mean everything, literally, very few firms, Lehman Brothers did go under, but they drew the line after that. There's a real risk that if the leash is ever let out, and it arguably already is on some of these firms, then they may precisely repeat the anecdote that you just gave, but in a somewhat different and arguably more destructive form.
I'm speaking with Stephen Mim, who's a historian and a co-author, along with Nouriel Roubini, of Crisis Economics, just out from Penguin. And if you really don't understand what just went on in a financial system, this is a very good book to figure it out with. There's one way in which it seems that this crisis is different from previous ones. I mean, there's a kind of model of a financial crisis in which some kind of invention, innovation of some sort, leads to a great deal of enthusiasm, overinvestment, speculation around that. But there is actually some technological progress that is financed through that bubble.
That's right.
We could even say that about the recent dot-com bubble. You know, the internet was financed, the basis of the internet was financed through some really crazy stuff, but, you know, it left something behind.
Mm-hmm.
This left behind nothing but a bunch of abandoned subdivisions, right?
Right, and that's what it is very peculiar about this episode, although not unique, but you're right. On the one hand, unlike, say, the internet boom, which at least left a lot of coaxial cable buried underneath the ground, this did not leave much. And what it did leave was actually, in many ways, a sort of negative, you know, as more of a liability than an asset. A half-finished subdivision isn't especially economically useful. It's odd, though, is that there was innovation, though. It just happened to be that the innovation took place within the financial sector. And that, again, has precedence, but was so toxic, quite literally, and so inimical to the long-term health of the financial system here, because we had so much brain power, so much capital going into making an increasingly opaque, impenetrable, and ultimately prone to break down financial system. So, but that definitely there are historical precedents there, although one could argue that we really kind of pushed it to a new level this time.
What precedents do you have in mind?
Well, anytime, for example, if you're looking way back and you're looking simply at, you know, the rise of joint stock companies, for example, the idea of, you know, using joint stock companies to raise capital and the stock manias that accompanied the rise of that particular institution, that happened in the 18th century. And then in the 19th century, you had, there were actually instances, in fact, where mortgage-backed securities played a role in late 19th century panics. So a lot of this stuff isn't entirely new, and a lot of the financial innovation, you know, has a precedent. But again, I'd underscore that the level, the complexity, and the sophistication, and ultimately the audacity of some of the stuff that was done, it's harder to find a precedent for that.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, so just the usual final question. What do you think of what we've done to prevent recurrences? Has it been enough
No.
Okay, tell us why.
Well, one, I don't think we've really tackled one of the central questions, which is compensation. That is, in my mind, and I think my co-author, Nouriel Roubini, would agree with me, that we haven't really addressed that issue head on. We have not addressed the question of too big to fail, because at this point it seems like a growing number of firms have been classified into that category.
But they're bigger than ever now.
Yeah, they're bigger than ever. This fact is consolidation, agglomeration that's taken place. And this is not only private firms, but also these odd so-called GSEs, government-sponsored enterprises like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So that hasn't been dealt with. Hasn't been dealt with either is, you know, there's something else that's been going on, and we began this interview talking about the crisis seems to have abated. I think it has, for now, but the European debt crisis, I don't think, is over. And that could ultimately be, you know, the next front in this particular conflict or this particular crisis. And that, I don't think, necessarily has been resolved. There is still this continuing fiction that a country like Greece can, you know, claw its way through austerity, you know, back to the bargaining table of the European Union. And I think it remains to be seen whether that's going to be true.
All right. Well, thank you. I've been speaking with Stephen Mim, who is a historian, University of Georgia, and co-author, along with Nouriel Roubini, of an excellent book, Crisis Economics, A Crash Course in the Future of Finance. Okay, let's take a break, and we'll be back to contemplate Cuba.
Hi, my name is Letty. When I'm in New York, I always have my radio tuned to WBAI 99.5 FM. And when I'm back home in France, I listen on the web at wbai.org.
Salut, je m'appelle Laetitia, et quand je suis à New York, j'écoute WBAI sur 99.5 FM. Et quand je rentre en France, j'écoute WBAI sur Internet à wbai.org.
And this is WBAI, not only on the radio at 99.5, but on the web at WBAI.org. And if you do visit the website, be sure to hit that donate button. We could use the help. Okay, let's take have another view of I Fought the Law. And that's some of the rewrite of I Fought the Law by the Dead Kennedys, in honor of the fellow who shot Harvey Milk and George Moscone. What's his name? Dan White, right? Who did the Twinkie defense and got away with murder. I Fought the Law and I Won, say the Dead Kennedys. Okay, a couple of weeks ago, Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic and Julia Zweig of the Council on Foreign Relations paid a visit to Fidel Castro and had a long conversation with him, which Goldberg wrote up on The Atlantic's website and made a lot of news around the world. Among the things, many things that Fidel said, aside from condemning Ahmadinejad for his Holocaust denialism, was that the Cuban economic model does not work for us anymore. And then shortly after that quote made its way around the world, the Cuban government announced that it was planning to lay off 500,000 workers from state enterprises. At the same time, it was going to license a lot of new private businesses and also allow private businesses, which have been growing under certain limited circumstances, allow them to hire employees, which is not something they've been able to do before. So I tried to get Julia Zweig on this show to do an interview, but she's been inundated with requests and was unable to do it. But the Council on Foreign Relations did host a conference call with Goldberg and Zweig earlier in the week, and got some excerpts from that, including, well, three questions, and the middle one mine. Okay, so let's listen to a bit of that, and then I'll be back to introduce an interview with Kirby Jones, an economic consultant.
Hello, I'm Sylvia Youssef from the German Press Agency. Thank you for doing this. Just today, the Cuban press said that the Cuban government is going to close like 500,000 of state employment. Do you think that this kind of confirms your theories that both Fidel Castro and Raul Castro are trying to prepare the Cubans, as you said also this morning in NPR, to the new situation? And how far do you think Fidel is going to let this go?
Yes, the Cuban press has reported this beginning today. They're doing a big rollout, letting the population know what it has been sort of pre-briefing for the last 2 years since Raul Castro took office, that the bloated state bureaucracy and the bloated state payroll is no longer sustainable, and that as a result, the sort of pre-1968 mode when small private businesses were permitted is going to be brought back in, although in a very different context, of course. Raul Castro is running that that show, if you will, and Fidel Castro is clearly isn't in the position to be able to permit or to permit it. He is acknowledging that it is going forward, and that's what the press is reporting today. How far do I think it will go? I think that's very hard to say. Things move very slowly in Cuba. What has been announced over the last couple of months since July includes allowing foreigners to invest in real estate, to purchase real estate, this now licensing of 250 to 500,000 private businesses, allowing people to employ one another, not just their family members, but an unlimited number as long as payroll taxes and Social Security taxes are paid. It's quite a long list if you add it all up, and the direction that it's going in terms of how deep this process goes, I think it's very way too soon to tell.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Doug Henwood with WBAI Radio.
Yes, thank you. I was curious, do you have any sense of what models the Cubans have for economic reform? Are they looking to China or the Asian developmental states like Korea? Do they have foreign advisors, or is this basically a homegrown experiment?
The word model, is, of course, implies that there's a model that others were emulating when Cuba had it, and that Cuba might now emulate or import. But I'll tell you something. This is a homegrown Cuban experiment. And one of the things that happened in the 1980s and the early 1990s after the collapse of the socialist bloc and the transition, for example, from authoritarian statist regimes to market democracies in Latin America and the sort of rise of the Asian tigers is that the Cubans sent their own people around the world to study the transitions, to study what happened. They drew some lessons from the perils of an excessively rapid economic transition, and they have drawn some conclusions, and as a result, from what I can see, are putting into place something that is pretty uniquely Cuban, but having said that, is taking place in a world economy in which so far there is small amounts of foreign investment going into the country, but sectors increasingly opening up. But unlike China or Vietnam, which is half the world away, and in Vietnam's case, 40 million people, China's case, a billion, but Cuba is 90 miles from the United States, has a significant portion of its population living in the United States, is part of this part of the world. And so I think the kind of geopolitical lessons of the last 50 years are don't depend on any one major suitor for too much because that imperils your independence, and don't just import some model that might well not suit your particular conditions. Actually, Castro has spoken, many Cubans that I know in and out of government have spoken about the mistakes that they made just importing the Soviet model lock, stock, and barrel before perestroika and glasnost. Fidel, in fact, was warning about emulating those models and started talking about perfecting their system. Now Raul Castro talks about evolving their system, and I really think it's a hybrid that is evolving that can't be said to be any one thing.
Hi, it's Folha de São Paulo from Brazil.
Hi, Andrea.
The encouragement that they said that they will make for these 500,000 people that will be unemployed to join the private sector or be self-employed seems a little vague, to say the least. Do you think that this is, from the perspective of these 500,000 people that are going to lose their jobs, a move that is safe to make?
Safe politically?
No, safe for those people that will be out of a job. What are they going to do, really?
When I was down there, in addition to the meetings that I attended with Goldberg, with Fidel Castro, I met with a number of individuals, economists, observers, people in and out of government, both Cubans and foreign diplomats and others. And I was actually, what I took away from that was a pretty solid consensus that there is a belief that there is so much pent-up demand on the one hand, skill on the other, that the people taken off the payroll will that the private sector is going to absorb them very, very rapidly, that there's plenty of opportunity and demand for services and for products. And if you look at the list of goods that of sectors, excuse me, in which private economic activity is now going to be licensed, it's very, very broad. And anybody that's ever been in Cuba knows that in the black market there has been you can buy almost anything and get almost any service, but it's in the black market. And now the government, as in much of Latin America, is going to flip things around and license the businesses and charge a tax, a payroll tax, and a 5% tax on profits. I think there will be an adjustment period for sure, but the basics on the ration card and the basic peso salary that people already, you know, before they're thrown off the payrolls receive are pretty minimum. So what you're talking about is losing a little bit from the state in exchange for the opportunity to grow your own business. And I think that's pretty significant given where Cuba's been for the last half century.
And that was the voice of Julia Zweig, a fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations, an expert on the Cuban economy, and a conference call sponsored earlier in the week by the Council on Foreign Relations. And we are allowed to use that audio courtesy of their permission. And now an interview I recorded earlier with Kirby Jones, who is a consultant based in Bethesda, Maryland, who works with a lot of U.S. corporations who would like to do business in Cuba. So we will hear from him on what his opinion of Cuban economic reforms are, where they're going, and what's going on with American corporations and their ability to do business in Cuba. Kirby Jones. The other week, Fidel Castro had a session with Jeffrey Goldberg and Julia Zweig, in which he famously said, the Cuban economic model doesn't work for us anymore. Many interpretations have been launched of this remark. What's yours? What do you make of it?
Well, I think it was taken a little bit out of context, but it's essentially a recognition, which is not new, that the Cubans feel their system needs correcting and needs to engage in some new efforts that they haven't done over the last many years, because the economic situation has changed, the local economic and financial situation has changed. So I think what they're doing really is just a reflection of their flexibility and their desire to start and engage in some new activities.
To most Americans, I think that Cuba has been nothing but an economic failure. What's your judgment of the last 50 years of Cuban economic experience?
Well, I mean, if Cuba's a failure, then what is Haiti? I think these words, some of these adjectives that are used are vastly overstated. Cuba tends to lend itself, or over the years, it seems to have lent itself to characterizations on one end of the extreme or the other, when in reality it's in the middle, just like all countries are. There's some good things that have happened. There's some not so good things that have happened. All countries have had their problems, not the least of which is our own. And no one would say that because of our problems, we are a disaster. And the same really is true with Cuba. And I think what you're seeing, and you've seen this over the last 20 years, really, this is not a new development. They change and adapt to changing economic conditions. If you go way back in the 90s, when Fidel was still head of state, they instituted and opened up to foreign investment. They legalized hard currency. They set up retail outlets so people would have places to spend their hard currency. Agricultural reforms have been moving for many, many years. So it's not the first time that they have adapted and changed. Quite the contrary, it's really the end of a process. The only other comment I'd mention is they do things differently than we do. In other words, we and our elected officials tend to make big announcements and then do the program. Cuba very rarely has a big announcement. And even the one that was made last week really ratified a process that had begun for some time. There have been experimentation with the expansion of private business and barbershops and beauty parlors. There is the expansion and sort of a test case of sidewalk markets and people selling their own goods along the streets in Santiago. They tend to do pilot projects before they roll it out. Now we've seen their rollout. And obviously a lot of questions remain, but it is a fundamental change in that country for sure.
You said there's good and bad in the Cuban model, and I would say that certainly they've managed to achieve very high levels of social development, a highly educated and healthy population with long lifespan, but at the same time, not a very high level of material abundance. Is that a fair characterization?
I can't argue with that at all. At the same time, they don't have a thin layer at the top of extremely rich people and then a bigger layer at the bottom with extremely poor people. You don't have the slum communities that you see in Rio with the favelas or in Lima or with the barriadas in Lima, et cetera. You have a squashing down, so there is they share what there isn't more equally than they share what there is. They have the country, the way it has been organized over the years, has produced some substantial social gains. I remember in a conversation that I had with Fidel, an interview I did with him years ago, and he explains, you in America have a different concept than we do. In your opinion, and in the way you look at things, the millionaire has the same freedom as the homeless person. Here in our country, that's not the case. You're not free to be a millionaire, but you're not free to be homeless either. Well, it's a long philosophical discussion of which is better, and so that's why I say it's gray. It is different. Finally, if you compare Cuba to the republics of the former Soviet Union or East Europeans, which also had communist systems, which have taken a very different approach in terms of they turned off one switch and turned on another switch. And you've seen the collapse in many of those countries of the social system. You have not seen a tremendous increase in foreign investment in many of the republics. And you have seen the development of that upper crust that has taken advantage of the new economies. In Cuba, you don't see that. And I think the jury is still out. But we're going to see how this new experiment evolves. But it's certainly the train has left the station in terms of a restructuring of that economy.
You said that they have experimented with creating sort of a parallel foreign exchange economy for tourists and such, and other experiments in small-scale privatization. Has this created any kind of polarization between rich and poor, or is that pretty much kept under control?
No, because there are no rich in the way that I think you mean or we would describe it here. And there are no poor in the way we see poor people in rural Mexico or in Haiti or in a number of other places. And it's not really a parallel market. I mean, every Cuban has access to hard currency, one in the form of remittances sent by the hundreds of millions into Cuba, and also because several hundred thousand Cubans work for the foreign companies and receive part of their salary in hard currency. So you have several hundred million dollars of hard currency floating around in the economy being spent in food stores and various other outlets. So yes, there is a divide. If you don't have relatives overseas and you don't work for a foreign company and you don't have access to hard currency, you're in a different position than those that do. There's no question about that. And there are rumors that have been circulating for some time, but they seem to be picking up speed of a unification of the currencies, where you have two different currencies. You have the local peso and you have the hard currency peso. I'm not an economist. I don't really know how that's done. I am told it's very difficult. But Cuba is moving in that direction.
I'm speaking with Kirby Jones, who is a longtime consultant to American companies trying to do business in Cuba. Now, are we about to see an acceleration of reforms following upon Fidel's remarks, but also with his brother now in charge?
Well, yeah. I think this recent announcement where they have said that 500,000 people are going to be laid off, several hundred thousands of those will be absorbed by what is essentially a new private sector. And what is interesting about the announcement, and what is another step away from what has been happening over the years, it clearly said that it's okay for these new private enterprises to hire people. There wasn't a number given either on the minimum side or the maximum side, but that means that if you're a plumber or you're a car mechanic and you do well, you can hire people and expand your business. So I expect, yes, the dislocation will be difficult. It's not going to be an easy process, but I expect, because so much of this is going on already, that you're going to see what is essentially a private sector developing in Cuba fairly rapidly.
In a conference call the other day, Julia Swagger, the Council on Foreign Relations, was asked about unemployment and what the Cuban government expects is going to happen to all these people who are going to lose their state sector jobs. And she said that she thought the government was rather optimistic that given pent-up demand for consumer services and also the high skill level of the labor force, that they will be rather quickly absorbed and it won't be much of a social problem. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it will be a social problem. I mean, it will be a problem. It is something that has to be dealt with. And if you're a person who's laid off and you don't get a job right away, well, we know that situation very well here in our own country. But for the reasons that I just stated, I think a number of them will slip into and come out of the closet, so to speak, and expand what they've already been doing. And in addition, the only other precedent for this is years ago when Cuba closed the sugar mills, and many thousands of sugar workers were laid off. There were stipends and there was a support system for them while they were undergoing retraining. So while I haven't seen the announcement of how they're going to deal with that, it would not surprise me to see some cushioning of those that lose their job to cover the time until they find a new job.
And let's talk a little bit about the work you do. You try to work with American companies who want to do business in Cuba. Now, of course, European and other companies are already doing business in Cuba, but it's a pretty steep challenge for American companies who want to do business in Cuba. What do you tell them?
Well, since 2001, American food and agriculture companies have been doing business in Cuba, and over the last 9 years, Cuba's bought something over $4.5 billion worth of U.S. food and agricultural products, and these are not just wheat and soybeans and rice, but it's all cookies and mayonnaise and cattle and telephone poles and all sorts of other things. 300 different products have been sold to Cuba by U.S. companies. The purchases have gone down in the last 2 years because of the regulations imposed by the U.S. government. But I think the precedent is set. I think if there were some changes in the regulations, that the purchases would go up, and certainly in the long term, the U.S. is Cuba's natural supplier. Medical products also has been allowed, and pharmaceuticals, which have not seen a great deal of sales over the years. Obama last year opened up the telecom sector, which also has not seen any sales because of the hangover of U.S. regulations governing that. So the U.S. companies, you're right, they're standing at the side of the party and watching everybody else dance. And it's not for any reason of the Cubans. Obviously, it's 100% the reason of the United States. Having said that, I think there is a feeling in the business community that at least a new climate has been established to some extent by the Obama administration, certainly one different than what existed under Bush. Cuba just announced last week that foreign investors can build condominiums and timeshares and have 99-year leases, very similar to what's done in Mexico, which will open up a whole new sector, which ordinarily would be a natural for the Americans, because eventually Americans are going to be traveling there in droves and would be the natural sector, natural target for these condominium, golf course, resort investments. So it is a bit frustrating. for the American business sector, because they're again standing on the sidelines while everybody else is doing whatever they can do.
I would think with the economy as crummy as it is, a lot of companies would be lobbying for what looks like an easy export market. What's it like in Washington now?
Some have, and there's been several bills in Congress, one H.R. 4645 particularly, which is one designed to eliminate some of the restrictions on the ag sales and to open up travel to Cuba for all Americans. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has been very strong and very supportive. The ag community has been very strong. Human rights groups have been very strong. Certainly the U.S. agricultural sector has been extremely strong because they want to see some of these regulations change. So you have seen in the last year the U.S. business community take a far more active role. We've yet to see whether the bill will pass or not. We don't know that. But we've certainly seen a manifestation of the interest of U.S. business to do business in Cuba.
And finally, is the major obstacle with Washington the Cuban vote in Florida, or is there a broader opposition to opening up with Cuba than that?
I certainly think that is part of it, and traditionally over the years has been a major part. Less so now. Obama, when he won his election, was the first national candidate, certainly the first presidential candidate, to win Florida and lose the Cuban-American vote, which sort of put to rest the axiom that in order to win Florida, you have to appeal to the right-wing Cuban vote. That no longer is the case. For a variety of reasons, the whole Cuban community, the Cuban-American community has changed. The younger generation now outnumbers the older generation. They have a different attitude. They're second and now third generations. So I think we're seeing a lessening of their support. Having said that, though, it is still very important, and it is paid a lot of attention to, and it's still... It still really is a major obstacle to getting things changed.
I've been speaking with Kirby Jones, president of Alomar Associates, based in Bethesda, Maryland. Jones has been consulting with U.S. firms seeking to do business in Cuba for the last three decades. Way back in 1972, he was press secretary for George McGovern's presidential campaign. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, the third version of I Fought the Law, this by Lou Reed, embedded in his song Dirt from his 1978 album Street Hassle. Till next week, bye.